This week, we're going to learn why it might not be such a good idea to try and sell to everyone. Michael has some leadership tips, and we'll talk about more about IoT startups. All that and more, so stay tuned. This is a Security Weekly production. Welcome, everyone, to Startup Security Weekly. This is episode 2, and I'm broadcasting live from GVNet Studios in Rhode Island. On the lines via Skype is none other than Michael Santarcangelo. Michael, welcome to the show.
Sir, it's always good to be here.
It's always fantastic to be here and doing podcasts, because it's like my job, which is awesome.
Yeah.
So,
funny how that works.
You got some great stories for us to talk about, and I want to get your take on an IoT type startup as compared to like a traditional embedded device company. I think there's a really interesting discussion that I haven't told you this particular situation. I'll try and leave out the names of the companies because I don't think it's fair at this point to mention them. But I think that's going to be a really interesting discussion. I'm very excited about that.
Yeah, I mean, what I like about the way that you and I are approaching this and in that we're looking at these stories every week is there's some fun stories in the news, but I want to go beyond that. So we're looking at things that are relevant and we're trying to stitch some of it together. So I look forward to that discussion. As you know, I have some questions for you about IoT and building on your embedded device background. And let's make sure that we offer people some insights on that. But I'll tell you what I thought was interesting this week is there was a discussion about startups and startups funding. And the title of the article is Never Mind the Startups, It's the Scale-Ups That Urgently Need Funding. And the thrust of it is basically suggesting that there's a lot of money out there for the early-stage companies. Now, I get it. If you're in the early stages, you say, no, there's not. I'm killing myself
here.
And what are you talking about? But what's interesting is, and they've given a lot of the examples and they've listed out the money to it, but their point was for the early stage, it's not so bad. It's that when that company crosses that chasm and they're at that point where they need not $1 million, but they need $10 million, $20 million.
So they're on their, they've taken their initial angel investment and they're looking to get their first serious round, like a Series A type funding, right?
Yeah. Now, here's what I liked about this article too that really factored into it. Sometimes it's not just the money issue. I don't know if you've heard this. It's a fairly common maxim now, but what got you where you are may not be what gets you where you need to go.
Mm-hmm.
One of the tough things a lot of times for founders, so this is of importance whether you're a security startup or you're a startup and you're considering your security issues, you get to a point in your growth where you need to rely on other people, mm-hmm. or you get to a point in your growth where you're not the right person for it anymore.
Yeah.
Now, it doesn't mean you're a bad person. It just means there's a particular skill set here. And so what's also happening at the scale-up side is the argument, and I think it has merit, is there's not a ton of people out there saying, okay, we're going to help you really grow. We're going to help you grow at scale.
Mm.
And I think that's interesting.
Well, and that resonates, a lot of that resonates with me, but I'm going to hone in on the security side of it because I know a lot of people in security who are awesome at what they do. And I mean, very technology focused, and they can understand the problem and build awesome solutions. But a lot of companies, like you're saying, Michael, reach that point where that's not necessarily the right person to take them to the next level. And so, yeah, money's great, but you need those people that can grow. And that can be a scary thing because everyone has this personal attachment, some more than others, to their startup, of course.
It's their baby, right?
Yeah. And now you got to let someone else kind of run your baby. And not everyone can do that, you know. But it's an important thing to think about and have in the back of your mind and plan for as you continue to build and grow. And I see that a lot in security because I'm in security, but because a lot of the security startups are founded by people who have awesome technical skills, right? So
about a decade ago, a friend of mine named Matt, it was kind of fascinating because he and I had a long conversation and he had spent some time in the world of institutional investment. And I can remember him asking me, would you ever sell your company? And I said, no, well, of course not. No, I've spent all the time on this. And he basically I mean, he's a friend, but he might have even been polite. But the bottom line was, Michael, you're an idiot. And this was before Shark Tank was popular on TV. But as Shark Tank's come along, it's kind of fascinating now, because you'll look at somebody and you'll say, okay, so you've topped out. You're doing $1 million a year. That's remarkable. That's a fantastic goal to hit. But if somebody came along and offered to buy you for 50%, but they could scale you up and now you're doing $20 million a year and you get 50% of that, you're doing $10 million a year instead of $1 million a year. If the money mattered, if the scale mattered, if making a bigger difference mattered, that's a smart play.
Yeah,
but a lot of people don't see that. So what I like about what you just pointed out is, when you're in that early stage, start thinking about that. Mm. By the way, I'd point out too, from a security perspective, because we're going to keep over the course of the next year or so working on this minimum viable security concept, whatever you start with, that's fine. But do recognize that at some point, the we're good enough part for security is going to shift away. Mm-hmm. And you're going to need some people that you can trust that are going to come in that are going to help you beef up your security. If you think about that stuff in advance, it gets easier when you get to that point. Whether you're talking about security or the structure of your organization, the leadership, the way you're going to handle the funding. But I thought it was interesting, because you don't tend to see people writing about that nearly as often.
Also, your next article is interesting about how entrepreneurs need to think about IT. I can say a lot of them probably don't.
Yeah, this article opens right up by saying, look, for a lot of people who run their own businesses, it's a necessary evil. A lot of us have experience in the enterprise side where it's not a necessary evil. Well, actually, I think in the enterprise it sometimes feels that way. Mm. But what happens is you're running a business and you're excited about whatever your concept is. That doesn't translate into, I've spent a career in tech, I understand tech, that's really where my passion is, but oh, by the way, this other thing I do is what kind of plays out. And so that IT becomes that dreaded thing you got to do in the background. But the argument in this article is, don't think of that in any other way than the IT is also part of your product.
Yeah.
It's part of what you do. And it just captured me. I looked at that and went, that's a really fascinating way to do it. I think the same thing applies to security people. Yeah. You know this because, when we're doing security startups, yeah, I get it. You came from the security realm. But then all of a sudden you start to find out things like, oh, I can't have perfect security and I really need to get this out the door. And getting it out the door and getting that market advantage is maybe a little bit better. Now, I'm not saying every security company makes those trade-offs or that you need to make those trade-offs, but it's just kind of an interesting way to look at it to say, okay, there's a way that you can start to say, this is all important. The world has moved to this IT model. We've moved to this cloud model. I need to think about how that integrates, but then I would argue, and how that lets me reach a scale, how that lets me do things I couldn't do previously. I mean, look, the way that I'm going to be launching the Straight Talk program, I looked at a decade ago, there were very limited options for me to have created anything online, and I thought they were hideous. Mm. But I'm looking at stuff now, I have to tell you, because I am reluctantly embracing the opportunities of educating ourselves online, because we're changing that paradigm and that model. But the deeper I'm getting into it, the more excited I'm getting about it. That's because I don't have to own all that tech anymore, right? So right, I guess I've made this mindset shift.
Well, and it can be a stumbling block for me to look at the negative aspect. If you kind of push IT to the side as you grow, you're going to reach a point where all of a sudden it's a major stumbling block, and now you got to play catch up, and you can't move your product forward because your IT is lacking. And I'm sure there's examples that I could come up with.
So
but
let's talk about this from a security perspective, because, again, let's leave the names out of it, but I can see the downside to this, because essentially what we're saying is there's a lot of platforms that are happening, and those platforms, and then there's platforms built on the platforms, they pretty much allow you to accelerate whatever you're doing, which takes somebody like me and says, hey, go focus on what you're really good at, and that's going to bring everybody else forward. So how do you know if you're picking the right platform? Because you mentioned that, but there's a company that I've talked to recently that they made a bet on a platform. Now, this was before everything was internet scalable, 15 years ago or so. And now they're looking at, they really helped me grok that whole technical debt concept, because they're like, well, we got to re-engineer it for the new world a little bit. So, I mean, as you're looking at stuff now with your startup, and when we've talked to other security startups out there, are there safer bets than others?
I think it comes down to how you want to invest the people investing in you. And right now, you know, you might choose technology that works because, you know, maybe we haven't had an investment, right? So we're going to choose technology that's cheap enough that does the job, knowing that as we grow, we're going to have to replace that. And my strategy, good, bad, or indifferent, is let's put the minimal investment up front, get something that works, knowing that sooner rather than later, we're going to have to migrate that to something better or bigger, right?
You know, I think I just picked up a key then in listening to you too. And that point then is I don't want lock-in. If I'm on a platform that's highly specific and everything, I mean, it will get me to market faster, but then I'm really, I feel trapped. I suspect that's going to be a little tighter. So that then means if you're a startup and you're a security startup in specific, think about how the enterprise and your marketplace is going to hopefully be adopting a similar mindset. Mm-hmm. Don't try to lock people in with something that you have that's very esoteric and proprietary.
Well, no,
show people how using you is the benefit. And oh, by the way, right, you didn't create an additional risk.
The difficult part with that is when you choose a platform like Amazon, you have a lot of, if you're building software as a service or cloud-based technology, you can get as much in bed with Amazon as you want or not, and where is that line? And I think many of the technology and security startups are flirting with that, right? Now, some have made the decision to build their own infrastructure. Certainly, that's their decision, and that has different trade-offs. But when you're looking at a large player like Amazon, there's a lot of decisions that we make on a regular basis. How much do we want to rely on that platform? Will we ever have to pull off that platform? What happens if Amazon all of a sudden kills that service that we're relying on? All of those things are very difficult decisions. And I don't know that I have the right answer there. It's obviously going to be different for everyone. But I think it's a really good example of if you're building something and you're building it on something as gigantic as Amazon, how tied to that platform you want to be.
You know, and again, so then that also suggests that as we work through this, we should do that gut check on some cycle and go, all right, how are we doing? Are we too invested here, mm-hmm, or are things okay? If this were to change, what's our ability to pivot? Is that okay? And I think that's probably too where if we got in the habit of doing that as security startups, as startups overall, as startups evaluating security, especially in some of these platforms, I think we overall mitigate that risk on multiple fronts. You know, it's interesting because if you've looked at the maturation of cloud, and I know you have and I have as well, 5 or 6 years ago, you know, you would say, well, I'm not sure if it's better for security. Today, especially in the B2B market, there are some compelling solutions, and I consistently argue that they are better for security than trying to do everything by yourself because they can be more focused. So, again, if you're a security startup, keep that in mind for people that mm-hmm. if you can show them how you've single-streamed this and you've got the best engineers and the best architecture, and you're really thinking about this better than anybody else could, you create a really competitive differentiation for yourself. If you're a startup who's looking at security, then keep in mind that these platforms are improving, and it's probably a good question to ask them, so how do you guys handle security, and how are you improving it?
Yeah, and it's interesting. It kind of ties into your next article, too, about who you sell to. And right now, we're in that situation in my own startup. And I know a lot of other startups in security specifically are in this place, and there's different ways to handle it. But, you know, you have a product that you can build in the cloud, but customers still demand that they want to have it in-house and not tied to the cloud for security reasons. And we can have a larger discussion about that. But when it comes down to it, from a business perspective, do I want to turn a sale away at this stage in my startup? Or do I want to just go build what the customer wants? And it kind of begs that question, you know, do you want to sell to everyone or be specific with it? I'd love to only sell to people that want it in the cloud. But as it stands right now with a security product, that's not feasible. People want it on premise. And you have to balance that. And I think some of the ways in which we kind of cheat are the customers are demanding it on premise, but investors are demanding that it be in the cloud. So you have both, right?
Yeah.
And that's just what that's the investment you have to make if you're a startup in security today. I believe, I don't know, you can send us email, psw@securityweekly.com, and we can have that debate, but that's kind of where I see it today.
Yeah, you know, I'd love to see that. And this might be an interesting segment at some point on the enterprise program too, looking at does the enterprise still require that? Because I will tell you, there's a number of enterprises lately that have started to aggressively look at how they can leverage the cloud to gain that competitive advantage. So whether we talk about whether we have enough people, whether we have the talent or not, or just what we can do to achieve scale and security to better support the business, I think there's some opportunities there. But the article is interesting because it basically says, stop telling me you can sell to everybody. Yeah. I always love watching it on Shark Tank these days because by this point in the program, if you're on that program pitching and you say, well, my market is everybody.
Everybody needs a security camera. Everybody needs a new beer cozy or whatever, right? It's no. Yeah. What you have to understand, I even think at the consumer level, but certainly at the business level, one of the things I learned working for a security vendor is how to define buyer personas. And I know it sounds all management and cliche, but it is important to define your buyer personas and have a sales message to each of those. And I would think that's something that investors are looking for as well. Certainly they're not looking for, we want to sell to everyone, right? And they're not looking for, well, we've got this one very specific persona and that's the only people we can sell to, right? There's a happy medium there. But as a startup, you have to start defining your buyer personas. Who is going to benefit most from that? What characteristics do they have that make it a really good fit for them?
I'm
working on.
Don't leave out the emotion. This is the thing we always look at is we get very perfunctory with it. They're this age. They work in this type of an environment. They have this type of a problem. It's great, but tell me about their emotion. Are they exasperated? Are they excited? Are you solving an affliction or are you helping them reach an aspiration?
Is there some urgency? Is there some urgency, right? That's definitely plays into it.
Yeah. So, you know, we just a lot like in the straight talk questions, right? The first question is, what's the problem you're trying to solve? The second question is, how tall do I need to be to ride the ride? Mm-hmm. Those are those sorting level questions. And it's fascinating the number of times I take a brief and somebody will say, well, we help everybody. I'm like, nah.
I want to talk about that when we talk about this IoT thing, because I think it's a good thing to talk about.
Well, and we should. And the point I want to make here is that there's some benefits to this. And I was telling you before the program, it took me 10 years to figure this out. But I had a guy explain to me, I don't know, maybe 12 years ago. And he said, Michael, who do you work with? And I did the whole, well, I don't want to turn anybody away. And he finally said, you know, if you think you do everything or you think you can serve everyone, then you don't really have a specific appeal to anybody else. And look, I got that. Logically, made sense. Even emotionally, it made sense. But then faced with, but I could make the money or do I not make the money? How do I want to handle that? I get that. Like, you've got bills to pay. You think it might help you. Here's what I've learned in the last 2 years. The more focused you can be, the quicker you can be. But not just the quicker on your development, but also the quicker on your understanding of the persona. Just me focusing on straight talk for the last 9 months, the way I started thinking and talking about it in November, radically different today. Fairly confident 6 months from now will still be different, better, more refined. And, you know, it's interesting because if you ask me who I serve for that, the bulk of my market is that security leader that when they do that gut check, are you valued for your leadership as much as you are your technical competence?
Yes.
They go, no.
Oh, I'm dealing with this on multiple fronts, and I think it very much applies to startups and, in my case, security startups, which is who I primarily follow. And you had this article in here, management practices can boost company performance just like certain technologies. So one of the – and I want to run this by you, Michael. So one of the problems that I think a lot of us have, especially in a security startup, is a lot of times the founders are very well-versed in technical. And we can do these other jobs, right? But we get to this mixed message that we're a good leader or we're going to build a great company if I just go in and do everything. And you have to, as a leader, what I tell people is enable other people to do those jobs. Even though you can do that job, you can't always just jump in and do it, right? You're not going to grow.
Oh, absolutely.
And I think there's a huge startup problem that everyone has.
Yeah, and that's why we're going to keep talking about this when we look at startups. What I'm absolutely resolute on is there are hundreds of definitions of leadership, most of them good at some level. So whether you like one or the other, I'm good. We've got no problems. But the mark of a leader is to elevate the people around them. And mm-hmm. one of the things you'll hear me say frequently is that we lead people, we manage process, and we don't boss anybody. I do not like right. the concept of the boss. I mean, when my four-year-old does it, it's cute. She's funny. But everybody else, no thanks.
Yeah.
But so what you just pointed out and what this article points out is it basically started as a question, right? Can we quantify management? You know, the funny part was it started with me was could we quantify communication? And I figured out how to. And then it was, well, could you do it with leadership? Yeah, why not? But what this points out here that I like was management's about processes. And so the key that I've learned over the years is that if you're capable of doing it technically, but now you're shifting into that leadership position, you still have some management responsibility. So you don't manage the people, you manage that process mm-hmm. so that those people can get their results. And at first, if you're not sure how, go track how you do it.
Right. Yeah, you have to figure out how you do it, define it, and communicate it, which is subconsciously some of the things that I've been doing, which is good. It means I'm on the right track.
Now, have you found then that sometimes when you document it, you look at it and you're like, wow, there's a better way to do this.
Yeah, absolutely. Documenting it is certainly – well, I think there's two stages of improvement, right? You have the process in your head, right? Sales process is one thing, right, that I've had to deal with. In any startup, you're going to have to create a sales process, whether you like it or not, right? Exactly. In some way, shape, form, or fashion, you're going to need a sales process. It's one of those kind of, if you're a technical person, those ugly things that you got to do, right?
I mean, you always look at sales like that ugly thing. You've been hating on sales for your
Yes, and now you're in that role, right?
I have to go sell.
So when you define your sales process and you, being in security, right, we've all, I think, have this kind of lens about sales. You have that in the back of your mind, and you're like, I'm going to define a good sales process that's not going to feel slimy like we all sometimes feel in security, right? Yeah, you can't feel slimy, right? And as you're defining it, you're like, oh, I'm going to, you know, make these improvements and do things a certain way. Then when you communicate that to your sales team, listen to them because they're going to improve upon it as well. Now, I'm very lucky. The salesperson that works with us for offensive countermeasures is very, very good. Awesome sales. So it's really empowering for me when I develop a sales process and, you know, 90-95%, he's like, that's great. You know, we'll make some improvements here and there. And that's really awesome. It's really awesome. So,
yeah. But see, what you just also illustrated, which is really important, is so the first step is you get out of your head and then you get to look at it and be like, I think there's some stuff I can do here different. But then when you give that over to somebody else, they might also find a better way.
Right.
That doesn't diminish your value. I mean, in your example, you've got someone that's their expertise. Of course they're going to have ways to help do it better. And by documenting it, it's not a he said, she said. You're not getting into argument over it. You're looking at a process. In the worst cases, you say, okay, well, let's go test it out. Let's go look at the results. But what I've learned, too, is that even somebody who may not have started out with more expertise, when they look at it and they work through it, they ask those questions. I saw something on Facebook I actually liked the other day, which was, you know, when you ask why, you learn. When you ask why not, you allow innovation to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we go through that process and we're making that transition and you're saying, well, I mean, we can do it that way, but this is our way. Yeah, you know, what I've learned is the individual nature, right? This is the way I've started to say it, is that we can honor and embrace our individual journeys without being in conflict in any way whatsoever with the universal nature of what actually works. You want to go sail your ship different than everybody else? Cool. Choose your own path. Do it your way. Wear whatever colors you want. But there's still certain principles that are going to come into sailing a ship.
If you're
going to win, we're all going to do those things. That's just the way it goes.
I like this article on opportunity. And it actually hits on a key point that you taught me and showed me some guidance on. This is about opportunity. And it's not just the article very clearly conveys this, right? It's not just about the opportunities you have. We can help people with security and everyone has this problem kind of thing, right? It's more about that question, why now is the opportunity, right?
Yep.
Yeah, great, you can solve a problem, but why now? And that's something that you're absolutely correct investors look for. It's actually very well documented, is why now? Why are we solving this problem now?
And it's elusive, right? I mean, the reason that we're going to keep pointing out stuff like this is because when you look at it, you go, well, of course, that makes sense. But then you sit down. You know, one of the things, we did a leadership summit this week, and when I tell you the five questions for the Straight Talk framework, you're like, oh, I got that. Cool. All right. Well, first exercise, let's sit down and fill them out.
Mm.
Oh, that's not so easy. So it's the same thing here. When you say why now, it's like, well, why now? Because security's hot. Because did you see the headlines? Because the cost of a breach is $6 million.
What are the environmental conditions that make it the best solution for that time? You know, is it businesses have this problem because of some external factor? Is it some internal factor that's manifested because of technology? Like, why? So
Bringing that up, what's great here is this is a fairly long read, but what I liked about it was it broke it down. It gives examples, and it gives really good examples. And then it even shows you some slides to show what it looks like. So what's great about this is, right, what I always talk about it is, you know, show me the current condition, show me the better tomorrow. Now, the thing I always talk about with this, right, and I call that the leadership roadmap, the current condition doesn't have to be bad. It just is. Just articulate for me the way things are. Show me the better tomorrow, which doesn't mean today was bad. It just means there's a better way to do it. There's something people aspire to. And then you got to show me how you're going to lift people up into that picture. Take that same concept here. What this article lays out really effectively is that even if you've got that all figured out from a security perspective, and it's crystal clear to you, it doesn't mean it's crystal clear to anybody else. First of all, unfortunately, when you're a security startup, unless you're only ever going to sell to security people, don't kid yourself, you're not, because they're going to have to go to somebody else and get approval. You have to be able to bring other people into it. So you have to show them what the current conditions are in the business environment, in the political environment, in the technical realm. And then how those contribute to create an environment or an event where if people know that you exist, right? You're either new. If people knew there was a way to do this, they would give us money. Or people are already doing this, but we can do it cheaper, better, faster.
Mm-hmm.
And here's how we're going to get the traction on it. That's important. But then also in your Better Tomorrow pitch, you've got to explain to people when you're talking about that opportunity, why you?
Mm-hmm.
Why now?
Right. So, yeah. That's a really good point.
And why you? You know, so what's your authority? What's your credibility? Or this is where we'll talk a lot about social proof. What's your proof? Because if you think about flip it around, whether you're the investor or you're the investor evaluating that whoever's going to make that purchasing decision, you could come to me with the best thing ever. Paul, I like it. I like the sound of it. I've watched you on the podcast for years. But now I've got to do that internal evaluation. And we tend to do this very subconsciously. What's the risk of doing this?
Mm-hmm.
If I do this, am I going to get fired? Because, you know, they said for years there was no risk in buying IBM. There was no risk in buying Cisco. There's certain established players that whether they're the best or not, they're good or not, doesn't matter.
Mm.
Your CIO heard of them. Your CFO knows of them.
Right.
You can get that PO. They can have you call 10 other CIOs or CISOs or somebody else that'll do it for you. So when you're coming in and you're pitching this opportunity, you have to show how what you have is remarkable enough in the timing that this opportunity is going to connect.
Michael, I want to bring some of the things we just talked about into an example that I haven't run by you yet, but I think it's going to be an awesome example, and I want to get your thoughts on it. And it's going to relate especially to not selling to everyone and the opportunities and why now. So many people that have gone to the store and bought a wireless access point, right? So the problem that exists today, and I'm not sure this is everyone, this kind of speaks to not selling to everyone, right? Many people have the problem where they don't get wireless in certain areas of their house. Now, the environmental factors that have changed have been there's far more devices in your home, right? All of your entertainment devices, your tablets, phones, computers, laptops.
I'll say what, I was shocked the other day when I looked at how many things were actually connected to our access point.
Yeah.
I went back and reviewed that. I knew everything that was attached to it, but we easily had 15, 20 things.
So this problem of dead zones and coverage in your house, I think was, you know, kind of livable 5-10 years ago, whatever. Now it's kind of it's a problem in your home. So I started researching some solutions for that, and I have two that I want to compare. One is a more tried and true wireless networking company that has a really good reputation with the nerds like myself. Like we all, like Larry was actually, we were talking, I was talking with Larry about it because he teaches the wireless class. And I'm like, Larry, I'm like, he's like, yeah, I recognize this tried and true company because I got a PCMCIA card from that company years ago and it worked great, right? Yep. So the nerds know this company and they make a solution. They can put, you know, three access points in your house. They got dual radios. It's $250. It comes with power over Ethernet. So it solves that problem of I want to put an access point like there, but how do I get power to it, right? I can just run it over the Ethernet cable. I can run Ethernet cables a lot easier than power. So it solves that problem. It's $250. Now, this new company that I hadn't heard of until recently is solving the same problem, right? These dead zones in your house, how do I get better coverage? How do I get better speed in my wireless network at home? And so speed is also a factor, right? Everyone's streaming Netflix at home too, so it becomes more important. Yep. So their solution is $500. It doesn't have the power over Ethernet, and essentially does the same thing. So I'm not discounting this new company, but I want to understand where my extra value is. I tend to think that it's in usability, right? Because to configure the tried and true, admittedly, it's not the most user-friendly system. But us nerds can figure it out.
Is it easier than putting together something from IKEA? That's the question.
Yes, that's the bar, right? So I'm curious to talk to this new company as it relates to our discussion, right? Who are you selling to? Are you selling to the nerds? Are you selling to the regular
people? I was just going to say, I think that's a key question because one of the things we look at with pricing is we have this tendency to rapidly devalue ourselves, whether you're a contractor out there on your own or a consultant or you're trying to put together your new product, you're always worried about, but what if they don't buy it?
Yeah.
It's amazing the number of studies that get done where they go, okay, I'll offer you the same product and this one's, you know, twice the price and it sells twice as well. Yeah. Sometimes it's the perception of value. So it's interesting in that second startup might have somebody advising them to say, nah, $500, people will pay for that. I mean, by the way, right, to name names, go look at the price of a Sonos right now.
Oh, yeah. Sonos has always been up there in price. And I tell you what, I have a Sonos, and I think it's awesome. And I recognize the value. Yeah.
Yeah. But therein lies that key point. You said you recognize the value. Now, you're right. I don't know the companies that you're talking about. I've got some thoughts on it. Mm-hmm. But I did see that there was a new wireless provider or a new solution that came out. And their idea, too, is that you could just add more into it. It would work great. You could work around your dead zones. And we'll mesh it for you. We'll handle everything for you. It's just plug and play.
Plug and play.
And we're good. And we're auto-updating. We're all this type of stuff. And I had put it out there, and a couple security people got back to me and said, you know what, I live in a house that's got plaster and lath, and trying to engineer my own solution is going to drive me insane, so let me try it, and we're skeptical, and one of the guys tried it, got back to me, goes, okay, I'm kind of impressed, actually.
Mm-hmm.
It works pretty well. So I think what you're pointing out is that the value may be in that user experience and in that usability of it, and so here's the lesson for security startups. Take the time, figure out some of that usability, but then explain it. Showcase the frustration and remind people that time is value.
Right.
And that, you know, you can engineer it yourself and it might take you 4 hours. And you know what? If you're you and you've got that wireless background or you're Larry and you teach classes on wireless,
I've got
a high level of confidence that both you guys can architect the solution, implement it, and then test it, be pretty good. But the average security person, I know we're expected to know everything about everything.
Mm.
I'm getting to the point in my life where I realize I know smart people like you, and I know questions to ask, which is a good, you know, if you're ready to segue. I mean, I've got some questions for you that I think are useful for people. But, you know, sometimes that's the advantage is knowing those questions to ask. And what I like about your question is when you talk to the company, just say, you're twice the price, so what's the value?
What's the value? That's my big question right now. And who's the audience?
Because I think that matters.
And I think even another question is, so if your audience is not super technical people, how do they justify that price? Are they willing to pay that price? I'm not sure. I know, because I only know from my own lens, my own perspective, how much I'm willing to spend. And I think it's really biased. I mean, so I bought two Raspberry Pis and I can do great things with them because I know how to load the operating system on the SD card and copy them and do all that stuff. But average users who aren't technical, maybe they have to pay more.
What do you value your time at per
hour? Well, yeah, that's the
other thing. You don't have to give us a number, but like, do you know? Do you have a number?
No, I don't. So that again is biased because when I do something like that, I talk about it on the show.
No, it's
so,
you know, it's,
and that's no, no, but that's how I just so that's how I justify my time. So yes, there is a value to it, but it has that in the equation is I know if I spend the time on this, I'm going to get value out of it because I'm going to present it on the show, and that's going to have benefits for the security community and also, for my show.
Also fair, if you said, Michael, I like it. This is, you know what? I've moved more into a leadership role. This is my opportunity to get my hands dirty again and work with it.
Right.
Okay, that's fine. Then there's no objection to it. But here's what I find. Most people don't know what their time is worth. I give everybody a really quick trick. It takes three steps. One, write down your salary, whatever you get today. And if you are self-employed or in your startup, write down, you know, whatever your deferred comp is or whatever your expected, you know, revenue is on the year. Use the gross stuff. Don't worry about the net. Just gross number. Write it down. Take the last three zeros, lop them off. So let's just say, because I like easy math, you make $100,000 a year. Now you're left with 100. Divide that by two. The approximate value of an hour of your time is $50.
Right.
Hour. And it's interesting because, I mean, I've got a background in economics and I've done a more detailed personal finance analysis of how to calculate the value of your time. You know, the thing that takes like an hour or two. It's more or less the same. This is a rough thing because now you can look at it. So let's take those two examples. One is $250. The other is $500. But the $250 one is going to take you 10 hours to set up, and your time is worth $50 an hour.
Right.
Okay, so you're paying a $500 premium on it. Now, if you come back and say, but Michael, I enjoy this. It's going to feel rewarding to be done with it. Mm-hmm. Okay, knock yourself out. That's great. Here's where it starts to matter, though. You can't do that with everything. So when you're in that startup and you're a security startup, right? Let's go back to what we were just talking about.
Yeah.
When you have to start leading people and helping them develop and manage those processes properly, sometimes you got to step back and say, yeah, I can do it, but that is not the best use of my time. And there's a better way to do it. Now, then that means as a security startup, as you learn that lesson, incorporate that in your marketing. Yes, you've got a better product, and it's technically sufficient, right? Betamax is, by most accounts, better than VHS. I think VHS had porn, and that helped them. But VHS also, you know, they had a better marketing message. So do spend time on that experience and connecting with people and reminding them the value of their time and how you're going to save them time, because time is money.
So it'd be interesting to report back on my findings.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah. And there's probably other players in the space too that I want to research as well.
Yeah,
certainly there's a lot of people making the play into the home wireless experience, and it ties into our IoT discussion as well.
I was just gonna say, so let's use that as that pivot point. I noticed, and I didn't really throw any up this week, but there's IoT articles pretty much now every week, and I suspect that there's a certain number of people like they're grinding their teeth as they're trying to read it to go, but that's not IoT, but. Here's my advice to anybody. Set that stuff aside. You know, it's kind of like getting in this argument about whether it's cyber or not. Yes, it is. Mm-hmm. Next, like, please, that's not the right place to put your effort. But here's the thing I've looked at. And I've asked you this question before, and I want to see how our collective thinking has or hasn't shifted on this. So here's the construct. If you are pondering something IoT related today, somebody gave it that label, so it says IoT. Mm-hmm. What are three core questions that we should ask? And then what I want to do is go look at them from three perspectives. If I'm the startup, what do I need to think about when I'm asking that question? If I'm the investor, do I think about it differently? And what am I looking for in those answers? And then as the purchaser, and if we need to, why don't we separate it out to a B2B versus a B2C? And let's see if we suss anything different. So somebody comes to you and they say, hey, I've got this great new IoT device. What are the top three things that pop into your head that you think we should inquire about?
Yeah, I think, of course, we've talked about updating and how important that is. If the device gets updates, how often does it get updated and how are the updates validated? Right. I don't know if that's one, two, or three things. Right.
But we could probably put it into updates and then nuance it. So I like it.
Yeah. Also, I think coding practices as it relates to support and backdoors. So basically, and Ed Skotus was actually the one that articulated this on the Security Weekly show a couple of years ago. And he was kind of putting on a call to action for a standard way in which we authenticate to. This might have been before IoT was like in every news article, but how do we authenticate to IoT devices? for management, maintenance. I'd actually separate that out into two different things.
Didn't how we do solve you... this with SMTP? Yeah. SNMP,
right?
Yeah.
Well, there's two different roads of authentication, right, that we need to tackle. So authentication is the main issue. How do we authenticate to the device for management and maintenance of the device itself? And then if we need to authenticate it from the user perspective, how do we do that? So the accessing the functionality of the device, does that need some kind of authentication? And I think those are two things that I wish we had some more standards on. But I think authentication is a huge issue. If I look at the problems, they all kind of trace back really to those two major issues, Michael, is software updating and authentication are two of the major ones.
So does it matter? One of the things I looked at before was just kind of asking, hey, who made the chip? Does that actually matter? Does it matter where in the world it was manufactured?
It can. So that can tie into updating. If your chip is only going to be manufactured for so long, and then rather quickly you have to switch to a different chipset. Now you've got version 2 of the device, and how long are you going to support version 1 of your device? And that's a cost thing for the business, right? So if you're using this hot new chip, and it may only have a life cycle of a year or two, and then you got to switch to something different. You have to keep doing that every year. Now you're supporting 6 different versions of your device.
Well, and are you assuming too, based on your background with embedded devices, I know the answer to this. I'm trying to think of the way to phrase it, but if I go out and I buy a chip today, does the average startup, even in security, know enough to look at the coding of the embedded chip to decide whether it's a good choice or not?
Yeah.
What's driving that choice?
Functionality, certainly, and cost are driving that.
So if you do what I want you to do at a right price, I'm probably going to buy you, whether you were the most brilliantly designed and architected chip or just the cheapest thing somebody could throw together.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
All right. So I've kind of broke it down into then still like tell me a little bit about the chipset, although I accept that we're going to downplay that. And it really is going to come down to then how's it updated and how's it protected. And the primary driver on that is going to be the authentication, both from an administrative perspective as well as from a user perspective.
Yeah. There's more to that too when we talk about IoT. I think how it an offshoot of authentication is communication, right? So many of our IoT devices today, there's software on the device, and I take it out of the box and I put it on my network. I interface with it over my local network, so there's that connection. But then that device likely talks up to the cloud for some other kind of functionality. So there's really like all of these pieces together, and then there can be a web application on the device, and then there's a web application in the cloud. And then if you're interfacing both with the device locally to use it, and you have a cloud system that you're logging into as a user, that's one interface that needs to be, two interfaces that need to be secured. Then if you have an API, that can be completely separate, and that needs to be secured as well.
I didn't realize it was this simple. Everybody makes it sound complex, Paul. What's going on?
So, right. So think of it, let's use a Nest thermostat as an example. So there's firmware on the Nest, right, which needs to be secured and updated. Then my user interface to the Nest is, I push the thing and I spin the wheel. So I really don't have to interface with it locally over a web browser, for example, right? But there's an interface on it. And there might be connection ports if I take it apart. Security-wise, that's not as important. But then there's the way that that thermostat communicates back to Nest over an API, and that's different software, from when I log into the Nest web interface or use their mobile app. Now there's two more interfaces. So the API for the mobile apps might be different from the API from the web application. Certainly the web application is separate from that. So there's lots of moving parts and pieces of code that you need to think about security in. So IoT, when we talk about IoT security, I actually talked about this in my presentation last year at B-Sides Las Vegas. When we talk about IoT security, there's a lot of different components. There's a mobile app, there's firmware, there's API, there's web applications. It's really the security of all of that that encompasses what we call IoT security today.
All right, so let's break it down a little bit further. Not so much further. So we got those three basics. So you're a startup today. maybe you are a security startup, but I know that one of the challenges we look at from IoT is, but how are we going to secure all the IoT?
Mm-hmm.
So, all right, you're a startup today. You've got this hot new idea, the next best IoT device. 8 billion people want it. It's going to be hot. What do they need to think about relative to those three things?
Yeah, so firmware updates is going to be big, right? Okay. So we talked about that. Choosing the right APIs and choosing the right web applications, right? So determining how the management of the device is going to happen over some API connection, and then choosing what software platform you're going to build other user interface components on.
All right, and so when you're looking at that too then, because I always like it, and I don't mean to sound as flippant, but somebody will say, because I'll ask very high-level security questions. What if somebody tries to use it to do X? And people always go, well, who would do that?
Yeah.
And I always say, well, you don't know my friends. They would do that,
right,
just to try it. But so how much time would you allocate to this? I mean, I, in my head, this is kind of like an hour or two discussion of, did you at least ask the question and probe around a little bit? So, like, let's do updates. I'm questioning, like, I'd want to know how frequently would I need to update it? Do I think I need to update it? What would that process look like? Have I given that any consideration? Sound about right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And then when you're looking at, in terms of your APIs and your connections and that type of stuff, we'll fold the protection into that. But as you've listed out, holy cow, there's a lot there. So what are some things, I mean, I know right now, so you're looking at something that could be on-premise or in the cloud. That feels like that's probably a slightly lengthier type of real rundown. But at that high level, let me think this through. What are a couple security pointers that you would have?
Yeah. So
that people probably overlook.
The biggest one, the best recommendation I have is to make sure that you choose as few technologies as possible. So if you're going to have an API on the device or in the cloud, use that same API as the foundation for everything. So the mobile app, the web application, and maybe even the device itself is all working off the same API if possible, so that you're supporting one code base. You know, there's some systems where, you know, the web interface is using one API, the mobile app's using another API, and the device gets updates and management through a different API. Like, standardize on all of that so you're maintaining as few different code bases as possible.
Right, and so the art, and that seems to, like, by supporting one code base, if they were to have some catastrophic vulnerability in it, you can still deal with that easier than trying to split your focus over five or six different things, which, you know, one might get popped, but the other five could still have challenges or problems.
Right.
And that,
yeah,
that interplay, right? It's a split of the focus. And so trying to be perfect by saying we're going to have so many layers here, no one could ever figure it out, probably also means, and neither can you. So why don't we be smarter about it?
Yeah. Yeah, and I think as you build secure coding practices, if there's one, you know, more centralized code base, it's better. And the example I have for this is actually when I worked at Tenable for Nessus, right? So Nessus had the API. When there was a mobile app for it, it used the API. When you used the web interface, that was accessing the same API. When people wrote third-party utilities, it's the same API, right? So you're maintaining one API. Then as your product grows, other products use that same API, so you're not building multiple sets of code, you're basing it off that one code, which means that API has to be very robust.
All right, so for the investors out there, angel investors, institutional investors, people looking at this going, okay, that's neat. I hadn't thought about asking those questions. Because to me, this is going to talk to the viability of that startup, right? Like, I still appreciate and will maintain that the better communicated startup has the better advantage. But one of the things that I've seen consistently in security especially is, But we do give a lot of merit points to a better crafted solution technically.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're an investor looking at this, it feels like you can ask the same questions, but would you ask them the same way? Or how does an investor need to think about this when they're talking to that startup, right? Because you know that person, they're excited, they've got a pitch, it's probably not answering any of the questions they want to have answered, and they'll have their own strategies on how to ferret that out. But what would you guide the investor to ask about?
Yeah, I think asking about the architecture is going to answer a lot of questions. In general, you know, how is it how's it architected, right? Now, how are the
Why did you make those choices?
Yeah, and why did you make those choices? Because in speaking of the architecture, if all of a sudden they start talking about, well, we have this, you know, technology over here and that technology over there, I think the general question will bring to light how well the architecture is put together. And the answer to that is going to determine whether or not, you know, they've thought about security, performance, integrity, and uptime and availability of their product. Because all of those things factor into the decision for what technologies are going to power whatever solution you're building.
Yeah, no, I like it, right? And of course, if there's an investor out there and they want us to go deeper on this, I'd be happy to dig into it if they look at it a different way. I appreciate some of the investors I've talked to said, Michael, we're not really worried about that in the short run, probably because they're the early stage investor. But if you go back to our top story, when you're at that scale, you're going to get a lot more scrutiny and a lot more people are going to look at you. And that's why, in my opinion, these are the questions you start asking in those formative elements of your startup. You don't always have to have the perfect answer. You need to ask that question, because when you ask that question up front, when you get to that scale point, you've at least thought about it. Maybe you've made a better decision that now you can take advantage of. Because I get it. There's only so much time. There's only so much money. There's only so much attention. Sure.
Absolutely.
But asking the questions sets that stage. All right. So now you're a client. You're an enterprise client, and you're asking a question. What do you ask?
Yeah. So we get asked those questions all the time. You know, how
so what do you find people asking you?
So they ask how does it do the collection? What's under the, you know, under the covers? What language is it written in? How does it communicate back? And what's that look like? You know, what's the web interface written in? So they are asking very pointed questions about the architecture and relating that back to their own experiences of what works and what hasn't. And a lot of times that is not necessarily a security discussion, right? It's more of a performance and scalability discussion. But if you've chosen the right technologies, you know, security can more easily play into some of those than others. So
yeah. All right. So since you have any types of questions, I've got two follow-ups for you. First one is, what's the most surprising question that you've had so far, but then when they ask it, you're like, oh, that was good?
You know, a lot of people ask how it scales. I don't know if that's necessarily good, right? So we have to kind of talk about our solution. You know, then we get questions like, well, what database are you using in the back end? Which is really great for us because we get to talk about where we've been and where we're going and why we made those choices, which makes a ton of sense.
So you got a good story. Right? I like that.
Yeah. Like we started with Elasticsearch and that falls flat on its face. And that's something people are familiar with. And you're like, yeah, that falls flat on its face. We know that. We switched to MongoDB, right? And, you know, we're not writing any of the code in Python or Java, at least higher, like we're using Go because that was the best solution performance-wise. And so people get to learn about our technology and understand that, yeah, we've made some of the decisions that we think are right and people tend to agree.
So building on Microsoft Access is not advisable, is what you're saying?
Not advisable. Not advisable. I mean, different technologies are great, but what we try and show the potential customers is that we chose what we believe are the right technologies for this
purpose.
Right,
but you thought about it. See, I think that's kind of the point to this, too, is that you need to, you know, part of asking the question is asking the question. And then so here's that corollary to it. Have you found now that by talking to potential clients and actual clients that you have changed your pitch, that you have realized that there's stuff that matters that you need to explain better?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. That's an ongoing process.
In fact, I would argue, at least for me, that's it's become my favorite part. It's the first. It's the most nerve-wracking because you're terrified. You don't want to get blown out. And then you'll start to realize there's some stuff you just explain really well. And then there's some stuff that eventually, like, and I always find for me, it's that somebody will say, wait, so doesn't that do X?
Yeah.
And you look at it and you're like, huh, yes, it does.
Yeah, you can head off.
Hold on, I got to write that down.
Yeah, what you do is you end up heading off some of those questions. So, you know, we get the question all the time, hey, do you support all these different log formats? And it's like, no, that's not what we do. And, you know, here's the reason why. The development time basically to support all these different log formats would just take away from what we do.
And we'd be muddled like everybody else.
And they're like, well, what about XYZ? And we're like, well, you know, if we support XYZ, they put a different timestamp on their logs and it doesn't let our patented algorithm like do what it's supposed to do because, you know, they put the timestamp like once the packet was captured, not when it was seen, and there's a shift and that just throws everything out of whack. So we do all the collection and there's a reason why. And we can show them the results of that. So,
yeah, well, and so, all right. So, and again, I just want to bring it back real quick too. So we were talking about Internet of Things. So you're an enterprise, you're a business level consumer. And when you ask some of those questions, you are going to ask about the architecture and the APIs and those decisions. And I think really simply too, it just comes back. I think sometimes if you just say, what's your process look like for updates? What's my experience going to be? And how are you protecting the device? I think are probably pretty good conversation starters.
Absolutely.
And then see where it goes. I know we've talked about this a lot over the last year or two, and it's people keep telling me consumers don't care, and so there's no effort to it. I want to spend a minute or two and say, what could a consumer start to ask? But then I think the thing there is, how do we help them start to discern that better? And I'm going to challenge everybody who tells me the consumers don't care with really simple is they don't know what to ask. And then they don't know how to make sense of it. And by the way, I'm seeing this right now with executives and boards everywhere I work. I see this with investors. I see this with startups. And that's why I think it's going to be important for us sometimes to parse out some of these questions and look at how you and I and others think about these questions differently and start to share some of that knowledge and spill it out there. People care. They know it's important, but they don't know what to ask or what depth of importance. So what we basically said here is, you want something to update versus not update. You want to have some level of protection to it. I'll start out then. It seems to me if I'm a consumer and I'm buying some Internet of Things device, the question I'm going to ask really simply is, how does this update? And I'm going to tend to favor stuff that updates itself over things that require me to go and do it.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I think what's missing from that equation is some kind of standard on the security of these devices. And that's a question that I wish consumers could ask and get a good answer to. There is the cyber UL, so there are some efforts in
that. and that's pretty new. So
yeah, and it is new, exactly. But it's exactly that, right? It's like the UL verifying, some third party is verifying that there's a minimum level of security. Now, we can debate that, and people talk about PCI, I'd like to have some kind of consumer standard for these devices as well. I'd also like to see that in healthcare, certainly. I think it's an industry that's hurting on that. SCADA and ICS is another industry that can benefit from that as well.
Yeah, and you know what? I listening to you, that gives me ideas for future segments. Like, we can do one on startups focusing on healthcare and startups focusing on SCADA, and then look at those corollaries, because, gosh, my brain just fired in 10 different directions. But if I come back to this, one of the things I think is interesting then is, you know, so Google's into it now, right? Google has their own wireless, and Apple, right? Apple's pushing most of their stuff to auto-update. Microsoft is starting down that path as well. So do you think that as those tech giants are looking at that from a consumer perspective, that will start to work its way into it, and that if they do those for their devices, is, you know, it's interesting. I saw an article. This is related. I saw an article recently looking economically, and it said what's driven most of our change in the standard of living in the last number of years, and is it the change in the way, right? So, like, is it government programs and training and education in the way we've trained and educated ourselves, or is it technology advances? And their conclusion was it's tech advances. Like, most of it's just the stuff we can do with tech. And so I'm looking at that going, you know, it's we can run around silly and say, well, if we could just teach people how to do updates, it'd be better. Yeah, but companies have come out and said, yeah, but you know what, how about I just do the update for you and it's all good. And then they start requiring it. And as we've continued to look at all of the pushes that Google's making on a security front, my sense on it is they're doing better on par than not. And if they're going to start putting that in devices and Apple's going to start putting in their devices, and those are two people that are very heavily consumer focused, doesn't that start to bode well for maybe a better trend?
No, it's a fantastic point.
So then if you're a startup and you're a security startup, or you're a startup and you're thinking about the security of it, definitely market to people, hey, by the way, we auto update. You don't have to worry about it. We'll handle that security stuff for you.
Right.
And by the way, as we see startups start to do that, the first ones, they're going to get that bounce. They're going to get that lift where people go, oh, well, this one says security on it. I like them better. But then as that marketplace matures and people start to figure it out, we'll be better off. So then on that second part, that protection, I think if I was a consumer, I would probably be more interested in how you communicate than how you authenticate. Do you agree?
Yeah. No, I completely agree. I think the communication and updating is more important than the authentication. I think it's authentication is more of a underlying issue. So,
and then that would just simply be, I would just ask that as a consumer, is just say, sir, how do you protect the communication?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, because I mean, there are you know, I've always evaluated the security devices and how they protect my information, and I think people more and more care about that. I mean, when we look at social media,
every time we look at it now, right? And this is something that I like that we do on Security Weekly is we'll look at some of these reported stories and go, right, oh, okay. So you went out to what's left of Radio Shack and got an antenna and some specialized hardware, and you were able to lift that signal and do something with it. Okay, it's pretty cool. I mean, you kind of have decent level of sophistication to do that. But we've seen recently, too, where we look at some of these more connected devices, if we want to call them IoT or not, and somebody will say, well, but, you know, a passerby can look at your camera. Okay, is that a big deal? I don't know. But I think it's valid for a consumer to start looking at it to say, but did it have to be that way? So I think, you know, same thing. If a consumer starts asking about those questions about how are you protecting us between those things, it matters. Keeping in mind, of course, banks will still tell us you're safe because we use SSL. And they still say SSL,
yeah.
Even though they're not using SSL, and that doesn't keep me safe once my information is on your site.
Well, I think the level of awareness on security for consumers and consumer-based devices will increase as people hopefully listen to our podcasts and spread the word, such as this podcast, which is nearing an end to episode 2 of Startup Security Weekly. What's that?
Do you have a cool title? Do you have a cool title?
My title for this episode?
Yeah.
No, I don't. We'll come up with one.
We'll after. Do that.
So we'll have this moment of...
It'll be really brilliant.
Innovation.
Well,
thanks everyone for listening and watching, Michael. As always, thank you. And we will see everyone on the next episode of Startup Security Weekly.